We all carry a working definition of blessing, even if we've never written it down. For many of us, blessing looks like life going reasonably well. Not necessarily spectacular, just the way we want it to. Well, steady, decent, healthy, kids doing okay. It's that feeling you get whenever you didn't forget everything that needed to happen in a great given week. Even if you didn't do it all right, you at least didn't forget anything. You survived. That's, I think, a baseline for blessing and what that looks like. We say things like, we're really blessed. But we say that in a particular context. We say that when things are coming together, when doors open, when we feel, at least for a season, like everything's on the right track. Things are going well, we're blessed. The world reinforces that picture. Blessing gets associated with strength, stability, success, security. Blessed people are the ones who seem to be winning. It's Super Bowl season. Some teams are blessed, others are not. We think this way. We think about blessing as confidence, capable, control. When people have enough resources to protect themselves from too much risk, that's blessing. When people are admired, they're blessed. When their lives look, at least from the outside, like everything's good, then that's some kind of confirmation that they've made good choices. They're blessed. This works because we tend to retroactively apply the idea of blessing backwards onto someone who is fortunate. So someone gets the promotion they've been wanting, that dream vacation, or they get to retire, and we name that as a blessing. But there's a particular ordering to that, isn't there? There's a good thing happens, and we name it blessing after the fact. Scripture, though, doesn't usually function in that order. It usually goes the other way around. And we do this when we want to, but not consistently. So sometimes we say someone is blessed, and so therefore good fortune is coming their way. We don't like to play that game very often because it's riskier, isn't it? Because if you're wrong, then what do you do? And it's easy, I think, almost without noticing, to slide from blessing into a different theological assumption that somehow God marks out favored people as blessed. If God is pleased with us, our lives will look put together. If God is with us, then things will eventually work out in ways that are visible and satisfying, not quietly, but like your neighbors will be jealous. If we're really walking with God, then we think that will show in circumstances that other people can point to and say, that person right there, they must be blessed. God has favor on them. Matthew tells us that Jesus has just begun his public ministry, right? He has announced that the kingdom of heaven has come near. He's called a few fishermen by the sea to follow him. He's begun speaking some good news. He's healed a few illnesses. His word has spread. Crowds are starting to gather. Houses are full. Hillsides are filling. People are pressing in with all their different hopes, their different expectations, because they want to see what this is going to look like. If God's reign is really breaking in, if Jesus is right, then this seems like the moment to spell things out. Lay down some ground rules. Who is in on what God is doing and who is out? Who is closest to the center of God's attention? Who's going to be first in line to receive the good blessings of this kingdom? At this point, Jesus is still new enough that a lot of people are showing up because they don't know what to expect and they want to find out. He sees a big crowd. He goes up a mountain. He sits down. His disciples come close. The crowd leans in to hear what he's going to say. This is the moment when, if our instincts are right, Jesus is going to name that those who are successful, those who are in power, those who are strong, those who are spiritually impressive are truly blessed. He's going to confirm the assumptions we already have. And if you're being honest, that's what you always want from somebody new in this position. Anybody who you want to be the guy who stands up and starts opening their mouth, you want them to confirm your assumptions, not challenge them. Nobody wants their assumptions challenged. Even if they're terrible assumptions, they don't want them challenged. You want confirmation. He opens his mouth and begins to speak words that will overturn and challenge those assumptions. The word of the Lord from Matthew chapter 5, verses 1 through 12. When Jesus saw the crowds, he went up the mountain, and after he sat down, his disciples came to him, and he began to speak and taught them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will receive mercy." And I think at this point everybody starts to catch on. I assume, maybe wrongly, that he's going to pick up the cadence a little bit to try to get through this awkwardness, because he's not going to look up, because this is not what you want to see. "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And blessed are you when people revile you, persecute you, utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. So rejoice, be glad, for your reward is great in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you." And what I don't know, and what I've always wanted to know, is the exponential growth of the rate of attrition during the Sermon on the Mount. Like, there's a great crowd at the beginning. I want to know how many people are still sitting there at the end after three chapters of this. That's what I've always wanted to know, because I assume, and maybe I'm wrong, but I assume that somewhere during all of this, there's a trickle-out effect. they show up to hear what he was going to say, and they've heard the craziness, and I don't assume the crowd is large at the end of this Sermon on the Mount, but we don't know. This is not what they showed up to hear. This is not what they wanted to hear. This is not the confirmation bias that they wanted confirmed. This is everything they did not want to hear. This is the exact opposite of the start of a good, strong campaign. This is how you tank a campaign. This is the end of it. He's clearly not the guy. And if we're honest, if we let these words hit us fresh with a fresh set of naive eyes and ears, this is deeply unsettling. Don't try to normalize this. I mean, we've heard this enough that we can sit down and be like, ah, yes, the wisdom of the Beatitudes. But if we're being totally honest, this is crazy. This is not normal. And we don't like it. We pretend like we do, but there's nothing to like here. You're not supposed to like this. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are those who do not feel strong, who know their own lack, whose spiritual life does not feel impressive or triumphant. Blessed are those who mourn. Try pitching that one at a funeral. I double dog dare you. You won't be invited to the next one. Nobody wants to hear that. Nobody. Blessed are the ones who are carrying grief, the ones who have lost, the ones whose hearts are heavy and whose eyes are dry. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are those who do not push their way to the front, who are not loudest in the room or quickest to defend themselves. Not once has that person ever been rewarded in society, in any society. These are not the people the world calls blessed. These are the people the world pities, overlooks, quietly steps around and ignores. And those are the best case scenarios, aren't they? That's the best we can do, is to ignore or have some pity. This is where my Southern background shows. This is where that "bless their hearts" comes in real handy. "Bless their hearts" is not a kind thing to say. It's a very insulting, passive-aggressive thing to say, to look down on someone. That's best we can do. These people don't look like winners. They don't look like they're in control. They don't look like a model for spiritual success. And he just doesn't stop. He keeps going. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, those who feel the lack of justice, those who know that there's a gap between what is and what should be. Blessed are the merciful, those who risk being taken advantage of. Blessed are those who are pure in heart, those who long to live without divided loyalties in a world that rewards compromise. Blessed are the peacemakers, those who step into conflict and usually get hit by both sides. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, who pay a price for doing what is right. None of these sound like strategies for getting ahead, because they aren't. If we're honest, most of us would not choose any of these for ourselves. We're not volunteering for these things. We would like enough faith not to feel poor in spirit. We would like enough blessing not to mourn so much. We would like a life where righteousness is already established, where mercy is safe, where peace doesn't cost us anything, where righteousness does not attract opposition. The Beatitudes do not flatter our instincts. They expose them. This is why I assume an exponential rate of attrition, because people are going to feel vulnerable with these words. They're going to feel seen. They're going to feel wrong, unsettled. The Beatitudes reveal that we have quietly trained our hearts to see blessing where things are strong, where things are steady, and to see curse or failure where people are weak, where people are grieving or gentle or hungry or opposed. And this is not Jesus offering us self-help list. He's not giving out a whole bunch of traits that you are supposed to acquire so that you can have God bless you and have God like you. He's naming the people that the world tends to pass by, and he's calling those people blessed. He's saying that the first signs of God's reign will be seen not among the triumphant, but among the needy and the open-hearted. That is disorienting. It pushes against our assumptions. It leaves us wondering that if this is what blessedness looks like, do we even want it? And if this is who Jesus says is blessed, where do I stand? To hear those words rightly, we have to notice that Jesus is actually doing something different on this hillside. He's not giving commands. Nowhere does he say, you have to become these things. You have to become poor in spirit, or you should try to mourn more. The Beatitudes are not imperatives. They're declarations. Jesus is not telling people how to earn God's favor. He's announcing where God's favor already is. That's what this is. This is a declaration of what already is. He's gathered a mixed crowd, disciples, onlookers, people carrying hope, people carrying heartache, people who look probably a lot like these Beatitudes, at least some of them. And he speaks this blessing over them. He's not saying something about the future. He's naming a present reality. He names that those whose lives feel most fragile, most unfinished, those who are most exposed. And he says, those of you who are that, you have not been forgotten. You are not outside the reach of God's kingdom. The life of God is coming to a town near you. It's coming to your home. It's coming to your heart. Blessing in the mouth of Jesus is not a prize for the successful. It's not a retroactive hindsight declaration of you've got everything, you must be blessed. In the mouth of Jesus, blessing is a word that creates space for those who assumed they were left out. It does not confirm the way the world already works. It reveals a different order centered on God's nearness to the humble, the wounded, the longing, the faithful. And Jesus himself is not standing apart from the people he's blessing. This is the only reason why the Sermon on the Mount works, for the record. As the gospel unfolds, we will see that he is also poor in spirit, depending completely on the Father. He will mourn over Jerusalem. We will see him cry over the death of a friend, over the hardness of heart. He will be meek. He will refuse to grasp at power even when he is mocked and mistreated. He will hunger and thirst for righteousness as he overturns tables. He will confront injustice and hypocrisy at his own risk. He will show mercy to everyone, even those who nail him to a cross. He will make peace at great cost, reconciling enemies through his own body. In other words, these blessings are not abstract descriptions of an ideal community. This is not utopia. This is a portrait of Jesus himself. They wanted to see who he was. This is who he is. When he says blessed are, he is describing the kind of life he is already living and the kind of life that his presence makes possible. This is the turn that the Beatitudes make. They do not invite us to climb a ladder to God. They reveal that in Christ, God has come down into the places that we have deemed furthest from blessing. The kingdom of heaven belongs to the poor in spirit because the king is found among those kinds of people. The kingdom of heaven belongs to those who mourn, and they will be comforted because the comforter has drawn near. The meek will not inherit the earth because of power. They will inherit the earth because the one who holds all things is also meek and gentle and lowly of heart. Blessing, then, is not a stamp of approval on our own successes. It's the gift of God's presence when you need it most. It's his ability to say, for those of you who are lost, I'm lost with you. For those of you who are suffering, I'm sitting right there with you. That is the definition of blessing. If that's true, then these Beatitudes are not a list of qualities that we strive for. This is a new way of seeing ourselves and one another and our circumstances in light of Jesus and his blessing. For this community that's gathered around him, these words become a kind of identity statement. This is who you are. Own it. Not because you've achieved something, not because you've achieved these traits perfectly, but because the kingdom has come near to you, has chosen to make itself with you, and you're standing in its light. This changes how we live together. In our world, where blessing is tied to winning, the church becomes a place where those who are poor in spirit are not shamed. They're held. Where those who mourn are not rushed past their grief, but comforted, accompanied. Where meekness is not dismissed as weakness, it's honored as a reflection of the King of Kings. Where hunger and thirst for righteousness are not numbed with distractions, but acknowledged, shared. Where those who suffer find relief, not fixes, but relief. In a world that rewards hardness, this community that's shaped by Jesus and his blessing becomes a place where mercy is possible. Because if we can receive mercy, we can also give mercy. Because we have been forgiven, we can also forgive others. Because if he can somehow forgive those who are nailing him to a cross, you can definitely forgive the person who cut you off on 66. You can do that. Where purity of heart is cherished, not as perfection, but as a growing integrity. Where a desire to live with a single, undivided loyalty to God is wholesome. Where peacemaking is practiced, not as an attempt to avoid or to dismantle conflict, but as a seeking of reconciliation, especially when it costs something or everything. This life of faith is not primarily about what we accomplish. This is about how Christ is present among us. And he chooses to be present among the lowly, as well as the uppers, but also with the lowly. For too long, the assumption was always God is with those who are successful. Or more modernly, we say God helps those who help themselves. The Beatitudes start with Jesus saying, actually, God is choosing to help those who nobody else is. And God is helping those who can't help themselves. It's different. It's uncomfortable. We don't create the Beatitudes by effort. We can only respond to them. We learn to trust that when Jesus calls certain people blessed, he's speaking a truth over against appearances that suggest otherwise. And slowly, as we live in that trust, our priorities shift. We loosen our grip on the need to appear strong. We begin to make room for the overlooked. We find courage together to stand with those who pay a price for doing what is right. We're not going to do that perfectly. The community on that hillside didn't do it perfectly either, and neither will we. But Jesus does not begin with critique. He begins with blessing. He names what God is doing, and he invites us to live from that blessing, not toward it. See, we get the order always backwards. We think a blessing is something we are looking to achieve in the future. We're trying to get to blessing. No, blessing here is a starting point for these people. And it's in a terrible, awful place, but they're looking forward to something brighter after the blessing. And that's why we come to this table week after week. Here at that table, Jesus does again and again what he did on that mountain. He gathers people and he speaks a blessing. Not now in words alone, but in bread and cup and fellowship. He does not invite the strongest or the most successful to eat and drink at this table. He invites those who are hungry and thirsty, those who are weary and worn, those who know their need. At this table, the poor in spirit are welcomed. Those who mourn are given space to bring their grief. The meek are honored, not trampled. And those who hunger and thirst for righteousness are given a foretaste of what God has promised. The merciful, the pure in heart, the peacemakers, even those who have suffered for doing what is right, all find themselves at the same meal, receiving the same grace. Because communion is not a reward for having lived up to the Beatitudes. It's the place where the one who embodies the Beatitudes gives himself to us. Here in broken bread and shared cup, Christ blesses us again, not with stuff or achievements, but with presence. He reminds us that the kingdom of heaven is nearer than we think, even when our lives feel far, far from complete. We don't come alone. We come as a people that is gathered together and named together. We come with our poverty of spirit and our mourning, our hunger, our thirst, our small acts of mercy, our fragile attempts at peace. We come not because we are already what these blessings describe, but because he has always been these things. Christ being these things, these Beatitudes, is our blessing. And he is willing to share that, his life, with us. So if you feel poor in spirit, come to this table. If you are mourning, come to the table. If you are hungry for righteousness, if you are tired of conflict, if you long for mercy and peace, come not to prove yourself, but to receive what only Christ can give. The table is set. Christ is here. And over this gathered people, he still speaks the first word he spoke on that mountain. Blessed.